Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore what happens when you work in an environment, maybe even your home, that has low doses of environmental contaminants. From University of Sweden, published in Environmental International, it's really bad. And we thought it took a lot of a bad thing to cause harm. No, it can take a little bit. Also from the University of Copenhagen, in this study, running slowed the cancer growth. Then we're going to look at how fenugreek, which is an important herb, benefits male menopause, what is called andropause. We're also going to explore, for people who feel, well, they have to have their protein from animals. Now, we know that's not true. There is no science supporting that. That's legitimate. All of your protein you can obtain from plants. But let's say that we want to make a shift. Instead of them killing veal calves and hogs, chickens, fish, how about insects? Well, from food environmental research, now insect protein has been found to be economically viable. So we'll talk about the people who need to eat the protein, well, from something that was a walking creature, insects. That's a better place to start than a cow. And for those of you who've been drinking your grape juice or eating grapes, I've said many times that a grape is one of the most perfect foods. With University of Leeds, which is in the United Kingdom, shows that daily consumption of the grape juice for 3 months can boost spatial memory and driving performance in this study, and a lot more on health and healing. Also, one of those days where I have so much good information, it's just how much can we fit in? I'm going to address the economy and give you some indicators of why I believe that what we're being shown in the media is not a true picture. And therefore, I would not feel comfortable by them saying things are fine. They are not fine. And then I'm always asked this issue. What are my thoughts about religions of peace and religions of war? Well, most religions have some statements that can be taken out of context or in context to support both. But I thought it would be interesting to share two highly articulate perspectives. Is Islam, for example, a religion of peace? And on one side of that is a debate that was held, and Ayan Hirsi Ali is one person. She's a woman well known for being one of the first members of her government elected, and she spoke out on women's rights. And then she had to leave the country because there were death threats. And she has one point of view. But another point of view is Maeed Hassan at Oxford, University of Oxford, has these famous debates, and he has a perspective. His perspective is that Islam is a religion of peace. So I'm going to play part of both of their debates, not the full debate. I have it posted so you can watch the full debate. The one would be an hour and a half. The other would be about I say around an hour. I'm only going to give you about 8 minutes of each, but the most important points of each, so you hear them in proper context. And then I'd like your feedback, your points of view. That'll be our talk back segment. Then, if time permits today, we're going to hear from a psychiatrist, board-certified psychiatrist, on antidepressants. And she has four principal tenets that will undermine most people's current understanding of the efficacy and safety of antidepressant medication. She is not in support of using the medications. So, and then depending upon what I can get done, we will. Also, I promised I would be doing the special report on Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own, Part 1 is completed. It'll be posted today. I should be finishing Part 2 in the next 2 days. I will do them both in one full hour coming up within the next 5 days. Let's begin, since we have a lot to cover. Historically, we have been led to believe, and possibly by those who meant well, that when something is in a very small quantity, it can't really do a lot of harm, and therefore our body's threshold can withstand a lot before it gets to a point that someone says, you've been exposed to too much. As a result, when women were shown to have DDT in their breast milk, all they did is say, well, you can handle that, and they upped the amount. And then when we saw all the women had that amount, we upped the amount. In fact, we upped the amount several times, and then we found out that that was wrong because it was going through into the breast milk, and it was not healthy. But that's true of almost all chemicals, including lead and mercury and arsenic. Even in tiny amounts, they're harmful. But then we live in an environment with over 80,000 human-made chemicals, and there are no studies to determine the synergistic, meaning the impact when you have a lot of those in the same house. Let me give an example. Not long ago, I was counseling a person suffering from a myriad of symptoms. They had a lot of tests, and the doctors they went to could find nothing wrong. So I simply ask a basic question. Is there anything in your living or working environment that may be precipitating any of your reactions? The person says, no, there's nothing wrong. So then I got more specific. What's in your mattress? I don't know. Is it made with flame retardant? Is it organic or non-organic? I have no idea. The sheets that you use, do you wash them with any kind of bleach, artificial softener, artificial fragrances? Have no idea. The furniture in your home, is it particle board? Meaning it's glued together, pieces of material glued together where very toxic, volatile chemicals are in there? Didn't know any of this. So I said, go home and take a look at everything, including your cookware. Are you cooking with aluminum? Came back and over 60 items that this person used without thinking that they were harmful were actually harmful. We have what are called organochlorine pesticides, or OCPs, that are used, very common. And they were banned in developed countries 20, 30 years ago. And yet, they're still showing up in people's bodies. Why? Because those chemicals that we take for granted, that we think are not harmful, are harmful. They don't go away. They can last for decades. Some could last a century. And the most commonly known of these compounds, well, was DDT. Well, research at a major university in Sweden has previously shown associations between environmental contaminants and diabetes, atherosclerosis, and strokes. Using the same large set, they have now shown that the OCPs, again, those are organochlorine pesticides, are related to future cognitive impairment. And that's because we are not paying attention to what we put into our work environment or to our home environment. So everything else in life set aside for a moment, let's just take a quick look around. Look under your sink in your bathroom. If you're using any of the non-organic products, throw them away and start, as finances and opportunity provide, to shift over where everything in your house is made of natural materials with no outgassing and no toxins. The cleaning materials, don't use those antibacterial soaps. Use regular soap, soap and water, and scrubbing. That'll do it without giving a cancer-causing agent onto your skin and into your blood. Same way with shampoos, hair conditioners, toothpaste, mouthwashes, everything in your life. Make sure your filter is on so you have clean water without the fluoride or pesticides or industrial residues. All of this makes a difference. So now we know that we are directly impacted by the very tiny amounts, usually imperceptible, and that can impact our brain. These are all known neurotoxins. So that's just the latest study. University of Copenhagen had an article published in Cell Metabolism, and it was about the benefits of exercise. In this case, it was a laboratory study, and they found out that in mice that were running, it helped better to shrink tumors, a reduction of 50% in tumor size compared to their less active counterparts. Researchers found that the surge of adrenaline that comes with high-intensity workouts helped to move cancer, killing immune cells, the natural killer cells, towards the lung, the liver, and the skin tumors. And that's a big, big difference. So the takeaway message is simple. In order to prevent cancer, exercise. In order to help if you have cancer, exercise. We have a lot of men in our society who once they hit, it can be any age between, let's say, 35 and 50. Things begin to change. First, they begin to lose muscle mass, energy, libido, interest in things that previously they had found important in their life, including their relationships. They tend to withdraw. They begin to develop some abdominal fat, belly fat. And this is generally what we call andropause or male menopause. It's rarely recognized, and as a result, people aren't helped. But a new study from the University of Sydney, which is in Australia, showed that fenugreek, fen, F-E-N-U-Greek, U-G-R-E-E-K, has enormous benefits. And daily supplements of an extract of fenugreek can reduce symptoms of age-related androgen decrease and boost testosterone levels in middle-aged and older men, and that's important. So we want to have a healthier free testosterone level, and we want to also have, let's say, more interest in life, the people in our lives. And this will help. This was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled study published in The Aging Male. So it's good. Fenugreek extract can make a difference. There are other things that can make a difference, but that's simple. Sometimes when I travel, I like to go to the farmers' markets outside the United States. I remember going to a farmers' market in Jamaica. It really wasn't a farmers' market. It was just a local market, and it was early in the morning. I had gone from the hotel where I was staying, ran down the road, and hit the fish market. And there, under these little tiny tin tents, it was just a sheet of tin held up by four poles, and there was a woman, there were many women, sitting with two buckets. One had clean water, the other was for gutting the fish. And in would come boats, and they would go over, and the fishermen would show them what they had, and the women would bid on them, and then whoever bid the price would get the bag, an old burlap bag of fish, and take it back, and then she would sit there, and she would cut out the guts in one and shake it in the water in the other. And then people from the local hotels would come down and bid on them. And when I asked the fishermen, those are awful small fish, they would say that's why at a lot of the hotels people are not looking, that they will make, the chefs will make, let's say, fish cakes and fish stews and fish casseroles and fish and salads, because they don't have to show a large piece of fish that an American in a fish restaurant would expect to see, because it's rare that they get a big fish, because these boats can't go out beyond the Barrier Reef, which is not very far. It was just interesting. And then from there, I walked over to where the beef was. And at first, I thought, that's the darkest piece of meat I've ever seen. And I got closer and closer and realized that it wasn't the meat, it was the flies. There must have been a million flies on this piece of carcass that was hanging. And then as people would come, they would, and this was there all day long in the sun, like at 98 degrees. You could imagine the contamination. And people would say, I want this, I want that. And they'd go over and they would cut off a piece of the meat and wrap it up and give it to him. And they had all kinds of vegetables and fruits. And I think it's interesting what we see around the world. And some of these markets are phenomenal. If you've been to the farmers markets in France, they're like three city blocks long and every kind of stall for every kind of vegetable in the world. And they open up at like 3 a.m. because people come in from the countryside because they start their days very early and the restaurants are the ones that get there first to get their selections. But when you go to South America, to Mexico, and some of the islands, you'll find beetles, you'll find insects, you'll find even scorpions, you'll find all kinds of these little creatures that are in these containers. And in fact, I'll never forget this. I'm standing there, and it was in Mexico, and they had a big bowl, a huge bowl, like a 5-gallon bowl. And this guy would scoop in and take a bunch of insects and put them on this piece of flatbread and put a sauce on it, roll over, and then the guy would eat it. And as the guy's eating it, the insects are crawling out of his mouth, and he's scooping them back in with his finger. I'm looking at this thing, man, that's the grossest thing I've ever seen. But there, hey, it's protein. Here's the latest on why this is going to start expanding. Quote from Food and Environmental Research, protein-packed milkshakes made from ground-up bugs are a step nearer to becoming common drinks, a consensus of leading scientists and policymakers have claimed. The potential for insect protein as an economically viable option for both human consumption and animal feed is now real and would sit within the current European Union regulations, according to the delegates to the Westminster Food Nutrition Forum. A Dr. Richard Mumford, director of science at the Food Environmental Research, said that that life cycle analysis of insect protein is good. Quote, where we get our protein in the future is a massive challenge to us. A huge amount of animal feed is imported, making it potentially one of the weakest food security links we have. Of course, commodity prices change, so you can only do a snapshot comparison, but our analysis finds insect protein often be very viable when compared with soya. So they're going to start getting the insects. Well, locusts, man, they could use that because locusts are devastating a lot of the grain crops throughout Africa. From University of Leeds, quote, daily consumption of the Concord grape juice for 3 months can boost spatial memory and driving performance. And we already know that the proanthocyanidins and the resveratrol and the grapeseed extract and the grape skin extract, all of these are important to us. There's over 5,000 studies. And this was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. But the reality is the grapes are just one of the most important things you can put in your body. I have found my own personal nutritional experience is that grapes are quite simply one of the top 10 things you can put on a daily basis into your body. So however you get it in, do so. And finally, from the Italian study of diabetology, olive oil on meals curbs blood sugar spikes. This is Rome. Quote, dressing food with olive oil can help contain blood sugar level spikes after meals in people with type 1 diabetes, a study by Italian researchers showed yesterday. And this was published in Diabetes Care. Now, keep in mind, in Italy, they consume a lot more olive oil than do we. And the Italians are connoisseurs of olive oil. We're not. So a lot of the olive oil we're consuming in the United States isn't real olive oil. It's soy oil, it's different oils with that they try to disguise as olive oil because olive oil is very expensive. These other oils are dirt cheap, and organized crime controls a lot of that market. I've been in a home that had over 40 different types of olive oil, and the one that they enjoy the most, the one that is the tastiest for them, was so strong I had a hard time consuming it. And because it was dark. It had a very strong taste and not the kind of wonderful nutty taste. It looked and tasted similar to car oil, the oil you put in your car. But it's very healthy. Again, it's an adapted taste. But they will frequently have olive oil in a cup. And then around that, they'll have either homemade breads, which you dip in to the olive oil. And it's almost never just plain olive oil. They'll put seasonings in it. And sometimes they'll mix a balsamic vinegar, vinaigrette. And so you dip that, and that's what you have, or crudités, like grilled eggplant and pepper and onion and mushroom, portobello mushroom. And again, they baste that heavily with olive oil. And then after their pasta is served or their rice is served, they pour olive oil over it. So they're using a lot of olive oil, which is one of the reasons that they're so healthy, have phenomenal skin, phenomenal hair. And so now, if you have diabetes, by taking olive oil with that meal, let's say you have some brown rice, put a tablespoon of olive oil on it. Or you have pasta, put a tablespoon of olive oil on it. And that will help keep your blood sugar from rising. And that's good. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough.
Oh, oh, baby.
Lovely.
My darling, I can't give up your love, babe.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I believe that we should take an honest audit of every governmental agency and where the money that they receive from taxpayers, you and I, goes to. We all know that we should be paying our taxes fairly. I support that. I believe that we should eliminate the ability of people who have the money and wherewithal to evade taxes legally because they can hire CPAs and money managers that can keep multi-billion dollar companies or very wealthy people from paying any taxes at all frequently. If we could eliminate all that if we had one flat income tax on all corporations, all businesses, no deductions, eliminate the IRS, and eliminate all that bureaucracy, and have it very reasonable, like 15%. Well, 15% is less than half of what it is now. Could you imagine the savings? No more offshore parking of trillions of dollars? That would stay in the United States. We would gain an additional $1 trillion a year in income just from right there. Instead, we continue with all the games that benefit those in power. And one of the games is the war on drugs. How much does it cost? According to Kit O'Connell from Anti-Media, over $1 trillion. Quote, the war on drugs costs Americans a staggering amount of money every year that it persists, despite the billions they receive. Federal, state, and local law enforcement have a proven inability to stem the flow of drugs on the nation's streets. Since Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs in June 1971, the cost of the war has soared to over $1 trillion. Over $51 billion is spent annually to fight the drug war in the United States, according to Drug Policy Alliance. It's also taken a massive toll on human lives. In 2013, at least 2.2 million people were incarcerated in the United States, with some estimating reaching 2.4 million. Making the U.S. home of the world's largest prison population. The vast number of those prisoners are victims of the war on drugs. And we don't look at what this does to them. And yet we continue to believe that it's not an issue. Let me tell you how big an issue it is. This is an amazing statistic. Someone is arrested once every 60 seconds of every day of the year for marijuana possession in the United States. That's according to Washington Post Christopher Ingram. And that's over 620,000 people for just pot possession. That's 1,700 people per day, more than one per minute. And keep in mind, a lot of states either don't report arrest numbers to the FBI or do so only on a limited basis, so it's probably a lot larger than that. So here's my thoughts. We should completely eliminate the entire war on drugs. Instead, we should set up holistic, humanistic treatment facilities in every community in America where people can go in, anonymous, and get the help they need to get off the drugs they're on and to understand why they feel that they're inclined to do the drugs and deal with the underlying issues that cause a lot of people to use the drugs in the first place. If we dealt with the problem instead of the treatment the way it is, and the treatment today is you go to jail, how is someone helped by putting them in jail for marijuana? They're not. I also believe that all those people's records should be expunged so that no one has to carry forward the stigma of being an ex-convict or having a drug possession, because that could bias them in getting jobs. I just think it's all wrong. If you take the profit out of drugs, then you're going to eliminate all those drug cartels out there. And then have an education program about why do we do drugs. We are the most addicted nation to drugs on the planet, more than China, more than India combined. Well, they've got a total of 2.7 billion people. We have 323 million people. Shouldn't we be looking at why we are an addicted society? And you could expand that to all forms of addiction. That's what we should be doing. And we should not fear that, a politician should not fear that if they say they're going to be considered soft on drugs, they wouldn't get elected. They should not look at it as soft on drugs. They should look at it as strong on helping people. That's just my thoughts on it. Now, I'm going to play you two parts, not the full discussion, of two sides of a debate on Islam. Is Islam a religion of peace? The first person we're going to hear from says, you bet it is. And he's an outstanding speaker. And let's hear what he has to say. This is at the University of Oxford in their famous debate. And then from there, we'll hear that Islam is not a religion of peace from someone who's also extremely articulate.
President, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Assalamu alaikum. Lovely to see you all here tonight. We are having a very entertaining night, are we not, with some very interesting things being said from the other side of the house tonight. Let me begin by saying, as a Muslim, as a representative of Islam, I would consider myself an ambassador for Islam, a believer in Islam, a follower of Islam and its prophet. So, in that capacity, let me begin by apologizing to Anne-Marie for the Bali bombings. I apologize for the role of my religion and me and my people, for the killing of Theo van Gogh, for 7/7. Yes, that was all of us. That was Islam, that was Muslims, that was the Quran. I mean, astonishing, astonishing claims to make in the very first speech tonight on a day like today, where the Conservative Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is having to come out and point out that these kind of views are anathema. And I believe you're trying to stand for the Labour Party to become an MP in Brighton. If you do, and you make these comments, I'm guessing you'll have the whip withdrawn from you, but then again, UKIP's on the rise, they'll take you, the BNP, they might have something to say about your views.
This is what Mehdi Hassan always does.
By the way, just on a factual point, since we heard a lot about the second speaker, about how backward we Muslims all are, on a factual point, you said that Islam was born in Saudi Arabia. Islam was born in 610 AD. Saudi Arabia was born in 1932 AD. So you were only 1,322 years off. Not bad? Not bad start there. Talking of maths, by the way, a man named Al-Khawarizmi was one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, a Muslim, worked in the golden age of Islam. He's the guy who came up with not just algebra, but algorithms. Without algorithms, you wouldn't have laptops. Without laptops, Daniel Johnson tonight wouldn't have been able to print out his speech in which he came to berate us Muslims for holding back the advance and intellectual achievements of the West, which all happened without any contribution from anyone else other than the Judeo-Christian people of Europe. In fact, Daniel David Levering, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of The Golden Crucible, points out that there would be no Renaissance, there would be no Reformation in Europe without the role played by Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd and some of the great Muslim theologians, philosophers, scientists in bringing Greek texts to Europe. As for this being our university, I will leave that to the imagination as to who is our and who is there. I studied here too. An astonishing set of speeches so far making this case tonight. A mixture of just cherry-picked quotes, facts and figures, self-serving, selective, a farrago of distortions, misrepresentations, misinterpretations, misquotations. Daniel talked about my article in the New Statesman, which got me a lot of flack, where I talked about the anti-Semitism that is prevalent in some parts of the Muslim community, which indeed it is. Of course, I didn't say in that piece that it was caused by the religion of Islam. In fact, modern anti-Semitism in the Middle East was imported from, finish the sentence, Christian, Judeo-Christian Europe, where I believe some certain bad things happened to the Jewish people. In fact, Tom Friedman, Jewish-American columnist in the New York Times, told me in this very chamber last week that he believed, had Muslims been running Europe in the 1940s, 6 million extra Jews would still be alive today. So I'm not going to take lessons in anti-Semitism from someone who's here to defend the Judeo-Christian values of a continent that murdered 6 million Jews. Moving swiftly on. Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm about to make that point. No, I'm about to make that point. You're right. I agree with you 110%. That is my point. I don't think Europe is evil or bad. I'm a very proud European. I don't want to judge Europe on the basis, but if we're going to play this gutter game where we pull out the Bali bombing and we pull out examples of anti-Semitism in the Islamic community, then of course I'm going to come back and say, well, hold on. I mean, look, let's be very clear. Daniel here was a last-minute replacement for Douglas Murray, who had to pull out. And Douglas and I have a well-documented differences, but to be fair to Douglas, as to be fair to Anne-Marie and to Peter, atheists. Atheists see all religions as evil, violent, threatening. What the problem I have with Daniel's speech is that Daniel comes here to mount this robust defense of Christianity, forgetting that his fellow Christians, people who said they were acting in the name of Jesus, gave us the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the anti-Jewish pogroms, European colonialism in Africa and Asia, the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, not to mention countless arson and bomb attacks on abortion clinics in the United States of America to this very day. I would like a little bit of humility from Daniel first before he begins lecturing other communities and other faiths on violence, terror, and intolerance. But, no thank you. Some water. But I would say this, to address the gentleman's very valid point here, I'm not going to play that game. I don't actually believe that Christianity is a religion of violence and hate because of what the LRA does in Uganda or what crusaders did to Jews and Muslims in Jerusalem when they took back the city in the 12th or 13th or whatever century it was. I believe that Christianity, like Islam, like pretty much every mainstream religion, is based on love and compassion and faith. I do follow a religion in which 113 out of the 114 chapters of the Quran begins by introducing the God of Islam as a God of mercy and compassion. I would not have it any other way. I don't follow a religion which introduces my God to me as a God of war, as some kind of Greek God of wrath, as a God of hate and injustice. Not at all. As Adam pointed out, you go through the Quran and you see the mercy and the love and the justice. And yes, you have verses that refer to warfare and violence. Of course it does. This is not a motion about pacifism. I'm not here to argue that Islam is a pacifistic faith. It is not. Islam allows military action, violence in certain limited contexts. And yes, a minority of Muslims do take it out of that context. But is it religious? We talked about Woolwich. Daniel and Anne-Marie have suggested that it's definitely religion that's behind all of this. Well, actually, what I find so amusing tonight is we're having a debate about Islam. And the opposition tonight have come forward. We have a graduate in law, a graduate in modern history, a graduate in chemistry, And, you know, I admire all of their intellects and their abilities, but we don't have anyone who's actually an expert on Islam, a scholar of Islam, a historian of Islam, a speaker of Arabic, even a terrorism expert or a security expert or a pollster, let alone to talk about what Muslims believe or think. Instead, we have people coming here, putting forward these views, putting forward these sweeping opinions. Listen to Professor Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, one of America's leading terrorism experts, who, unlike our esteemed opposition tonight, studied every single case of suicide terrorism between 1980 and 2005, 315 cases in total. And he concluded, and I quote, "There is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism or any of the world's religions. Rather, what nearly all suicide terrorist attacks have in common is a specific secular and strategic goal to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from territory that the terrorists consider to be their homeland." And the irony is, when we talk about terrorism, the irony is that the opposition and the Muslim terrorists, the Al-Qaeda types, actually have one thing in common. Because they both believe that Islam is a warlike, violent religion. They both agree on that. They have everything in common. Osama bin Laden would be nodding along to everything he said tonight from the opposition side. He agrees with them. The problem is that mainstream Muslims don't. The majority of Muslims around the world don't. In fact, a gentleman here started quoting all sorts of polls. Gallup carried out the biggest poll of Muslims around the world, of 50,000 Muslims in 35 countries. 93% of Muslims rejected 9/11 and suicide attacks. And of the 7% who didn't, they all, when polled and focus grouped, cited political reasons for their support for violence, not religious reasons. And as for Islamic scholars and what they say, well, Daniel talks about our University of Oxford. We'll go down to Oxford's Centre for Islamic Studies, get hold of a man named Sheikh Afifi Al-Akiti, who is a massively well-credentialed and well-respected Islamic scholar who has studied across the world, who in the days after 7/7 published a fatwa denouncing terrorism in the name of Islam, calling for the protection of all non-combatants at all times and describing suicide bombings as an innovation with no basis in Islamic law. Go and listen to Sheikh Tahir al-Qadri, one of Pakistan's most famous Islamic scholars, who published a 600-page fatwa condemning the killing of all innocents and all suicide bombings unconditionally without any ifs or buts. There's nothing new here. This is mainstream Islam, mainstream scholarship, which has said this for years. You don't go out and kill people willy-nilly in the high street or anywhere else, on a bus or a mall, based on verses of the Quran that you cherry-pick without any context, any understanding, any interpretation, or any commentary. Please. Well, it
doesn't happen, apparently.
I didn't say it doesn't happen at all. I never said it didn't happen. I don't blame Islam. Yes, it's a very good point. And a lot of us are campaigning against that. And we're campaigning against it in the name of Islam. We're campaigning against it in the name of various interpretations of Islam. Anne-Marie comes and scares us with her talk of Sharia law. I would like to see the book of Sharia law. It doesn't exist. People argue over what Sharia law is. And you empower the extremists by saying there is only one version. You empower them all. I don't believe you
several
took any interruptions,
countries.
Anne-Marie, so I think you should stay there for a moment.
Here's what we're dealing with.
I took your point. Here we are dealing with a 1,400-year-old global religion followed by 1.6 billion people in every corner of the world, a quarter of humanity, of all backgrounds, cultures, ethnicities, and yet the opposition tonight wants to generalize, stereotype, smear in order to desperately win this debate. And here's my question, if we're going to generalize and smear. If people say yesterday's bombers, and we've got to be careful, there's a trial going on, were yesterday's attackers, motivated by Islam? Big debate. I don't believe they were. Let's say they were. Let's say Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, was motivated by Islam. Let's assume, for sake of argument, that Richard Reeves, the shoe bomber, was motivated by Islam. If Islam is responsible for these killings, if Islam is what is motivating these people, and Islam is therefore not a religion of peace or religion of war, then ask yourself this question. Why aren't the rest of us doing it? Why is it such a tiny minority of Muslims are interpreting their religion in the way that the opposition claim they are?
And that is but one side suggesting articulately and with great deal of passion that Islam is a religion of peace. Now let's hear from a person who has the opposite perspective.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm surprised by the motion itself. When I first heard it, it reminded me of the academic question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? And I'd think, well, if you do the salsa or the cha-cha, not many. Why are we not having a motion on is Christianity a religion of peace? Is Judaism a religion of peace, etc.? Because those would be academic motions. Unfortunately, the motion, Islam is a religion of peace, is not academic. I respect and admire Ziba Khan, and I want to acknowledge the fact that you indeed are a demonstration of the assimilation of a Muslim individual, a Muslim woman, into Western society, into an American society, that you come from a middle-class family that was very eclectic and respected pluralism. I respect that very much, and I admire you for it, and I think you are an example to others. However, I disagree with you that you represent Islam or that you speak for Islam. The problem that is inherent in Islam from the time of its foundation up to this moment is who speaks for Islam. And I'll get to that later on. Is it Ziba Khan or is it Faisal Shahzad, who was also a middle-class man, went to business school, married an American woman, had two children, lived just like you, like many of you. And yet he made a different choice based on a combination of piety and politics. And that's what Islam is. And before I go on, let me define the key terms of the motion. First, religion. The most common definition of religion you will find is the universal quest of humans in search of the sacred or the holy. That search is expressed intellectually, it's expressed in practice, it is expressed in fellowship. And you look at a religion like Islam, on an intellectual level, it was expressed by the founder of Islam as a demolition of all other gods. Polytheism had to end, and all humanity had to be united under one God. From those of you who are familiar with history, and I think a crowd like this is, you know that no monotheistic religion can be a religion of peace. No monotheistic religion is a religion of peace, and definitely not Islam. Monotheistic religions know periods, lengthy periods of peace, but they also know lengthy periods of war. In terms of practice, yes, in Islam, you practice charity, you go to Hajj, you pray, all of that. But in terms of practice, there's also the expression, there's the concept of jihad. And I find it a pity that Ziba Khan did not mention that concept, which is central to Islam's conquests and Islam's success. The founder of Islam, Muhammad, in his lifetime, conducted 65 campaigns of war that were all successful. And that militaristic history of Islam is well documented. Just go Google it. And if you don't find it on Google, go to all those former empires that were conquered. The combination of a history of empire, of conquest, also leaves a legacy behind, and that legacy is the thrusting together of people of different ethnicities, languages, etc. So even if that empire declines, the likelihood of conflicts, of war, is probable. It's high, especially where there is a fault line. That's where Samuel Huntington had a point. That history of militarism, combined with the legacy of empire, those two points alone belie the motion tonight that Islam is a religion of peace. But that's not all. When empires decline, those who are defeated, and the Muslim empire declined, those who are defeated sometimes find themselves in a state of victimhood. That state of victimhood is exploited by the leadership or those self-appointed leaders of Islam. And what do you see? You see a number of people, and I concede it's a minority, who believe that Islam is under siege. A mentality of victimhood tells those who are conquered, who are vanquished, that the problem was caused by external powers, not by us, and that systematic denial within Islam after the 19th century to blame only outsiders exempt Islam from blame, from the explanation what went wrong. Yes, it was external. Yes, Muslims were humiliated. Yes, they were conquered. Yes, they were colonized. But how much was also because of the flaws of Islam? And that takes me to the point of absolutism. When the West went into its Islam, into its scientific revolution, why wasn't it Muslims? Muslims were the first scientists, arithmetic, logic, etc. They were great. Why didn't they get into that scientific revolution? Why were they left behind? Was it only because of external factors, or were there internal flaws? That combination of a status of victimhood and the absolutism, the demand that you can never revise or reflect on the Quran, that you can never, never, ever refute what Muhammad said, you can only follow his example. That absolutism combined with that status of victimhood is also enlarges the likelihood of conflict. And those two combined, like the other two factors,
Ayaan Hirsi, your time is up.
Thank you. That belies the motion. I'll keep my last two factors for the time I have.
Two points of view, only little snippets, but important. The full debates, which are extraordinarily well presented on both sides, are up on our website, and we want to thank the 256 million visits to my Facebook to review all that we put up there every day, every night. We put up more than, well, I just take a look, see what we put up in 24 hours and compare it to the BBC, Al Jazeera, CNN combined. And it is relevant material. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to take one real quick break because I have a real nice special to offer you today, something that I think you'll appreciate, and then we're going to go on to more material. This is Nuts and Stuff. This is a new product. It's raw, all-natural protein, fiber, the omega-3 fatty acids. What's in it? Well, I know that a lot of people should be eating more nuts. All the scientific literature shows we should be eating more nuts and seeds, but they don't. A lot of times they think, oh, it's too much fat. Wrong. It has just the right kind of fat. And in here, you're only getting 82 calories per serving, plus 4 grams of protein and 12 grams of fiber. Where are you getting this from? I have almonds, also something very rare, the organic white chia seeds, pumpkin seeds, flax seeds, hazelnuts, bananas, oatmeal, yeah, organic oatmeal, and coconut. Coconut's a superfood, and, of course, organic peanuts. So you're getting 8 different nuts and seeds in here, all in one scoop. It is vegan. It is kosher. Yeah, it's kosher. It's delicious. It's nutritious. And it's just one more complement to an already healthy dietary program, especially if you're using green stuff, greens and grains, red stuff, berry blast, muscle stuff. Now add nuts and stuff to that. And here's a special, never given this before. Okay, you're going to call this number, write this number down, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. You're going to get this for $55.99, plus you're going to get an $80 L-carnosine vegan capsules. And of course, if you've heard my programs, you know that I believe L-carnosine is quite simply the most single important nutrient that complements and supports. How can I say? I can't say it without making a claim, so I won't make a claim. It's just, it is a superstar in the league by itself. And a big jar, 90 capsules, I believe, vegan capsules of L-carnosine is $80. I'm giving you that free. So you're getting an $80 free bottle of L-carnosine. I take it many times a day, but you'll have it now and you can take it. It's costing you. You're getting it for free if you purchase for $55. Call 877-627-5065. You're getting Nut and Stuff to add to the other stuff you've got. 877-627-5065. And you're getting an $80 bottle of L-carnosine for free when you order it. Now let's go into our studio in New York City and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. So I just wanted to make a quick mention to everyone that our retreat coming up in August is full. I am looking for people interested in our work-study program, and those are people that have a good work ethic, and they want to help out the staff behind the scenes. You still get to enjoy the delicious food, the juices all day long. You can still go to different programs. They'll hear you speaking every night. And if people are interested in that, it's a little less money than the full pay fee. I'd like people to give me a call. My number is 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. Give me a call, and I'll go over all the details with you.
Good. Let us remember what is the whole point of the exercise. And this will be the only time in the next 12 months I'm doing this. I take a week. I ask people who are outstanding in their field to join me so we can help facilitate a unique experience for a week. People who want to start a journey of healing, a journey of health, a journey of joy, a journey of possibilities, starting over for a lot of people, ending a lot of crisis, ending a lot of drama, ending a lot of confusion in their life, looking in the mirror and thinking, how in the heck did I get to this place? I want to get to a different place. We're there to help facilitate that. Lectures, counseling, workshops, yoga, meditation, artist healing, all forms of water aerobics, water, mineral water baths, gourmet vegan food, juicing all day long, more juices than what you would normally ever have in a day, and you have this every day, classes on gardening, and in one of the most beautiful environments imaginable. You're up there in the mountains near Arkansas. And so you got the lakes and the tall trees and the eagles, all kinds of wonderful natural experiences. Just, it's pristine, it's pure, it's de-stressing, it's beautiful at that time of the year. You're in the middle of blooming flowers everywhere, canopies of flowers. And it's just magical. It's just absolutely magical. So if you care about your life, if you care about your health, if you believe you deserve a break, And you really want to give yourself a little time and attention, which maybe you haven't, then give Luann a call. Luann?
Yes, the number is 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198. And I just got an email the other day from someone who did attend. I wanted to read it to you. It's from Gwen, and she said, "Dear Gary, you inspired all of us to think, research, look for the truth, and live in harmony with our higher values. Your gift of enlightenment has helped me personally realize that I'm capable of much more than I was expecting of myself. I value your honesty and integrity and willingness to share and teach. You've been a guidepost in my life for the last 25 years, and having the opportunity to attend the retreat has been a dream fulfilled." I thought that was very nice.
That's very nice. Thank Gwen for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I wanted to give your number out one last time.
Yes, 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198.
And keep in mind, the regular guests were filled. This is for work study. So you can do work, and you can take in the classes you want. Luann, I want to share some points of view that on what I see the economy doing. Do not trust what you see on Wall Street. For example, when the stock market's gone up 500 points over 3 days, you think that's good. It's not good. This is all speculation. It's all trying to recreate a bubble by giving people the impression that oil's going to go back up and that that we're going to prosper again. How can you prosper when 200 million Americans are living close to the level of poverty? And not just here. Look around the world. For example, if you look in Great Britain, tens of thousands of jobs in steel, energy, retail, and government are being cut. I have the latest jobs report. For example, Tata Steel announced last month it's slashing 1,050 jobs, and around 750 of those jobs are in Port Talbot. What do you think that does to a community when 1,000 people working in one company no longer have the money to go to dinner or go to a movie or go to a concert or go buy clothes or just to do the things people do when they have money extra to spend around a community? It impacts it. It means that other businesses will be suffering as well. Another 300 jobs are being lost in the steel mill plants of Trostry. And Port Talbot used to employ 20,000 steel workers. But that's before cheap steel could be made based on cheap labor in China and other places. Now that's a ghost town almost. In addition, the oil giant British Petroleum, they're cutting 600 jobs, and then also that's 600 to 4,000 that they're going to get rid of. And additionally, the UK gas and oil is getting rid of 65,000 jobs. And now that the price of oil is low, they have to get rid of these jobs. But then there's all these other places. For example, British Gas is getting rid of 500 staff. And the cuts are part of a 6,000 job losses announced by the parent company, Centricia. So exactly, where are these 6,000 people supposed to get another job? And how is that 6,000 cut going to impact the towns that they're in? And you have another 300 jobs in just Leeds in the United Kingdom. And then I have a list of three pages of all the different plants. For example, up to 15,000 local authority jobs are being cut in Scotland alone. 15,000 jobs is a lot. In fact, in Edinburgh, 2,000 job losses. So you're looking at communities cutting back, and yet you don't see a word about this. So we're going to have the same thing, and it is happening in the United States. But behind that, you have banks, because who loans the money to companies that are speculating in oil, gas, and other commodities, including retail, when things are good and they have interest rates at zero? The banks. They give companies money to allow them to accrue debt with the idea they're going to get it back. Not true. We are way past that. Financial markets the world over are in complete chaos. And one reason is that they tried to repump up the bubbles. Well, bubbles never stay inflated. They always deflate. And because the prices cannot be sustained. So you buy a house at $200,000. Sure, it's going to go to $300,000. Then it breaks and it goes down to $100,000. Well, you just lost $100,000. The trouble is you mortgaged the house for $200,000 or you borrowed against it. So everywhere we're seeing this happen. In fact, today, here's what you have to listen to. There's a mathematical reality in the United States. We have $200 trillion plus in debts and plus $500 trillion in the United States and around the world in unfunded or underfunded liabilities. And that can never be repaid back. It's not going to happen. So central banks have tried to come up with all forms of debasing the currency, but it's not working. And then they try what they did in Greece. They simply privatize everything. But remember, when you privatize an airport, when you privatize a dock, when you privatize a tourist destination, that privatized money does not go to the local economy. It does not go to the state. It goes to those people in Germany or other countries that brought in and bought that. So what do you do with the local people? You fire them. Well, how are they supposed to live? You don't care. What if they can't afford food? Let them dumpster dump, dive. So that's what's happening. So that the people who can fly in private jets and have penthouse apartments and fine art, they're doing fine and they're going to continue to do fine. But everyone else is dealing with the deflation out there, and it's arriving and it's huge. And that means that the value of the assets that were purchased or paid for by debt have completely lost their value. That means that all that went down. So this next crash, I believe, will be worse than anything we've ever seen, including the Great Depression. So you're going to have all those industries that were buying and creating debt when oil was going high, $110, $115, $120 a barrel. Now it's at $26 and going south, may go down to $15 a barrel. Big problems. And it's not going to reverse itself. So we have too much debt, way too much debt, and we can't pay off the debt. Well, we should. We could. We could have a debt holiday. We could forgive student debt. We could forgive all of the payday debt. We could do all that, but we won't. And look at what happened in Canada. They got $8 a head cauliflower because they based everything upon always growing oil. Well, oil's tanked. And so now with the tanking of oil, the revenues are down. And so as a result, iceberg lettuce, which is a worthless lettuce in my opinion, sells for $3 Canadian, up from typical 90 cents. Broccoli goes for $4 compared to $1.50 in the past. And last winter, cauliflower was going for $2.50, now it's going for $8. That's what happens when you end up having an economy that is fueled by energy like oil or gas collapse. So we have this black hole of deflation. It's swallowing the entire economies. And even after the central banks have pumped trillions of dollars into the economy, it just isn't working. So what's my suggestion? My suggestion is put your money into, I would, my opinion, silver and gold, and also get out of debt. Whatever you have to do, tear up your credit cards, don't incur any more debt, and make yourself as solvent as possible. And then look for better places to live. Look where you can share the future with other people who have similar ideas. I believe there's going to be a renaissance of people going back to smaller communities, back to the land, homesteading, people getting into learning new trades and talents and barter and fair exchange in sustainable environments. California, Southern California, not a sustainable environment. Nevada, Utah, not a sustainable environment. Other places, yes. Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, upstate New York. Yes, those are sustainable, have good water, good soil, nice people, progressive communities. But this whole fetish about living in big cities, you're going to go broke in the process and stress yourself. I believe that we should be looking at realigning our life to do more with less and change our values. There's a philosopher, Sun Tzu, T-Z-U. He wrote a very important book called The Art of War. And in one sentence he said, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. If you know yourself, but not the enemy, for every victory gained, you also suffer defeat. If you know neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle. Look at that now as a battle not against an army or others, but what we deal with each day in our insecurities, the illusion of what's supposed to make us happy, the false beliefs in institutions and the gods of politics and rock stars and reality TV of showing us the right way, which is never the case. We better know the enemy, and we better know ourselves. The enemy of greed, insecurity, fear, and the certainty that if we embrace any more a non-sustainable environment, believing that somehow the bubbles will be reinflated, that there'll be a benevolent person who will wipe away the debt and give us an opportunity, that's simply not going to happen. So we have to start taking it upon ourselves, working with those of a like mind for the future. I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program.